And I keep remembering things that I should have put on before, mostly things you would be interested in. And I assume, girls, that you'd want to hear about what kind of clothing we wore. And of course, I'll have to go back to where it was in Robertsville and Winston and so forth. But, of course, after we had grown up, and I mean grown up enough so we didn't wear diapers anymore and all, we wore underwear. And in the wintertime, that was long underwear in the form of all one suit, you know, something like that. Pajamas that the kids wear, where you had long buttons going down the button, and you usually had an opening in the back for important reasons, and sometimes they called it was a drop seat type. There were buttons you'd have to use to drop the flap down when you got into the bathroom, and then you had to button it back up again. And then they came, it was a nuisance to button those buttons up, but then they came out ones where it was just a long slit-like opening that closed with one button or so, and that was a lot easier. But long underwear. But in the summertime, we put on, got those up. We put on what they called BVDs. BVDs, and of course the kids initiated right away what it meant, and they said it stood for babies ventilated diapers. That was just a joke, you know. But all right. Now, what next we had? The shoes. Oh, heavens. You know, I can remember the first shoes. And the first shoes, I can't remember them. I just barely remember them. I guess it's when we were up in Robertsville, 119, during World War One there. And I can remember having button shoes, the shoes that came above the ankle, and they were leather, but they had buttons on it and buttonholes on the other side, and you had an awful job, a terrible job putting those things on, so they had a little device with a hook on the end of it. They called it a button hook, and we had to use those to put on. But it was just a few times that I can remember button shoes, and then afterwards we just had shoes that laced up, and of course they were always up above the ankle. I think it was not until I was about almost in high school before I got any shoes that were below the ankle. All right, on the shoe, oh, the other thing that was... when we were up there on the farm, once there was a traveling salesman came around, and they used to come around trying to sell things to farmer people, you know. He held up the cutest little pair of boots, felt boots, and my mother fell in love with the looks of them, and she had little Freddie trying them on, and they just fitted, so they bought them for me. And they were a delight, those felt boots, because you could go in the snow, and we used to work in the snow to school some of the time and walk along the stone wall if the road was all filled up. But those felt boots, what would happen when I get to school, it was like a stocking out of felt. Your whole foot went in it. And then on top of that, you had a sort of a rubber, a big rubber that fitted, you put on like a separate rubber, and it had a fastener on it, just like the fasteners, those metal fasteners they have in Ardex. And that would hold it on. Well, lots of times in school, of course, when you get there, the teacher would have us take them off, and then she'd help us get them on afterwards. And the same thing home, you have to take them off. But what was nice about it was at home at night, you take the boot part off, and then you could run around the house in the felt portions. And they dried easily, and they were so warm. They were just wonderful, those felt boots. Well, I don't know, when we get around more shoes, we wore the ones that come up above the ankle. But I remember the ones, when I got to Bristol, I think it was when I was a freshman in high school, we got one of the most wonderful pair of boots. Well, they were leather boots, all laced in the front, and they laced up halfway between my ankle and knee. And I used those for several years, I think. But I remember using them going to high school with them. And wearing them almost up until April or May, anyway. But they were all leather and a rubber sole. No, I don't remember if it was rubber or not. I don't know what the sole was. But my dad used to smear them with oil, and he used to use castor oil because we had castor oil in the house, and it was a wonderful leather preservative, and it prevented them from, they would say, practically waterproof. You could go in the snow and all, and your feet wouldn't get wet on the inside. Since then, we found out that a lot better oiling stuff is, instead of castor oil, is what they call neat's foot oil, and that preserves leather. They use that for softening the harness up on the farm. They use neat's foot oil. Well, the next layer of clothing going from the feet up, you know, is stockings. And, well, we had to have stockings in those days. Boys didn't wear any long pants until a lot later, you know, till they get 13, 14 or so. So they had to have short pants, but then they had to have stockings. They couldn't have any bare legs in between. So we had stockings, and they were usually black, just black. And they had to hold them up in some way, you know. And they were cotton stockings, if I remember. Yeah, sure. Maybe there were some wool ones. I don't think we could afford any of those. They were cotton black stockings. Well, you had to haul them up. You had to have a pair of garters. Well, they had these darn garters. And maybe you've seen garters. Some of the females still use them, I think, for holding up their silk stockings, their nylon stockings. But this had a pin at the top, something like a safety pin. And normally, if you, with long underwear, we could pin it to the long underwear, and then it was about 6 or 8 inches of elastic, and they had a double clip arrangement where you could adjust that in length so that they would look better. They would be uptight. And then there was this same fastener that fastened to the top of the stocking. They were a lousy thing to have, especially for a boy. And it was only a few years that I remember using those when we were in Winsted, I think. I think I can only remember them in Winsted. Now, in the summertime, didn't have long underwear to pin to. They had another device. I don't know which. They used to call it a waist. W-A-I-S-T, a waist. It was like a vest, almost like a vest, no sleeves on it. And lo and behold, down on the right and on the left, there was a metal fastener in there with a little metal tube, and you could put the pin of the garters through that and close it up, and so it, you'd held your stocking up without ripping and tearing and pulling on it all of the time. These, they called them waists. And I can remember only a few years having to suffer with those darn things. Of course, the pants that went with these, some of the pants were just short pants that stopped above the knee, and you didn't have to wear the knee holes in the knees at all. But most of them went over the knee with a small system for buckling around below the knee. Sometimes just a buttonhole and a button, and you ripped it around and tightened it up there. That was the pants, and all pants were like that, I think, up until first pair of long pants. And that was an ambition a boy has. It was sort of a symbol that he's growing up, that he's in his long pants, man. He had grown up. Isn't that awful to think that? But that's the way we were. However, a special blessing was sneakers. When the summer months came around, we could wear sneakers. And everybody wore sneakers. They were called Keds, most of them, K-E-D-S. And that name, of course, was just a patented name from one of the manufacturers. But everybody called them Keds. Well, it's about time I got back to the regular itinerary. We got finished with the clothing we wore. Anyway, we're in Bristol, you know. And what did I want to go to next? Well, what year was that? The year we moved to Bristol was the fall of 1922. I established that by finding out just when it was that President Harding passed away. And he passed away the next summer, in August, I guess, of 1923. And that was that. What I told about before in the last tape was the winter of 1922. Now we're in 1923. And a lot of that took place. Our relatives from Brooklyn still, my cousins, I had two cousins there, Herbert and Edward, and Uncle Leslie and Aunt Emma, and they had a new car, and so they used to come up to visit us. They had this car, never heard of it before or since, but the name of it was called a Scripps Booth, and the engine sounded like an aeroplane. It was such a boom all of the time, but they used to drive up here to see us, and many times in the summer, like that summer of 1923, they would take us down with them to Brooklyn for a couple of weeks and then bring us back again. And of course, when we got to Brooklyn, it was great. There were so many things to do down there that were new to us in the city, in a beautiful big city. Aunt Emma used to take us to Coney Island, and Coney Island there had its own ocean swimming beach and all kinds of different amusements. Luna Park was one of them, and Steeplechase was another one. And she would buy us a combination ticket, which would allow us to go on all of the different rides, all of them, and we were never able to go on all of them. There were too many. I remember particularly the flying horses, they called them, because you got onto a horse, something like the ones they have on a merry-go-round, only the things didn't go around the circle. They just took off and went a tremendous long distance through the backyards and up over on roofs and all over, and you hung on afraid to fall off, and you finally get back. That was the best one of all of them, but there was an awful lot of ride. That was a thing to look forward to it there. In fact, I remember coming down one of the chutes. They had these wide chutes with waves in them, and you'd slide down. And I turned over accidentally on my stomach, and I burned off on one elbow. That is, skinned the elbow right down to the bone. And Aunt Emma, of course, took care of it for a while, but it left a great big scar. I still have it today that I got at Steeplechase. It was quite an adventure to come in that old Scribbs booth into Brooklyn, because you'd have to go on Route 6 from Bristol to Thomaston to Woodbury and Danbury and down through the Bronx. You know, it took 7 hours usually, and usually we'd have one flat tire or so on the trip. And one time we counted 7 flat tires, and the reason was somehow or other some glass, broken glass, got into the shoe, and every time we repaired the tube and put it on, it would go for a while, and then it would cut through again, and another flat tire. And of course, when the flat tires, we had to pull the shoe off, and then pull the tube out of it, and repair the cut in the tube, and put it back in again. And then we pumped it up. Now, we had to pump it by hand with a pump that you held between your knees and with 2 feet on it, and you pumped up and down. And that took a long time to pump that tire up to get it hard enough. And so we boys had that job. So we'd swap it between Herbert and myself and Edward, and back to Herbert again to pumping those tires up. Those were the good old days. Well, in August of 1923, I guess it was, when President Harding died. And, of course, the news traveled. We had bought newspapers, and we didn't go listen to the radio for news. So news came in various ways, because I can remember when President Harding died, the woman next door on the second floor next door hollering out the window to mother, and mother hollering back and say that told her that the president had died. That's how we found out about it. Of course, we had a vice president for that emergency in case anything happened to the president. And of course, Calvin Coolidge was at home in Plymouth, Vermont at that time, and his father gave him the oath of office. He became the new president. And his father, I think, was a justice of the peace in town or something like that enabled him. He had the authority to sign, to read the oath of office to his own son. And I don't think it's ever been done before or since. I think I've sort of stirred up some of the muddy stuff up in the gray cells up here, and I'm beginning to remember more things about, and it was, it was that year in 1923 when we lived at number 10 Beach Street. And I don't know just when, but I think it was in the spring or so of 1924 when Dad and Mother bought this house two doors away, that they were for sale. The houses became available to purchase if you wanted. So they bought this house, and I think it was the best one in the whole Burns Tract. It was on the corner of Beach Street and Crescent Drive, and it was beautiful for that standpoint because it's only about 100 feet from the canal that runs out of Burgess Pond, and about 200 feet from the pond itself, about 200 feet from the ice house, I guess. But the house had, we lived in, it was a two-family house, of course, and we lived on the second floor, and we rented the first floor to other people, and different ones, French people, most of the time that had come down. What happened, that was 1924, I guess. And I think that summer, we had the most fun on Burgess Pond because we learned to swim. We fished, of course, at every opportunity, but we learned to swim that summer over, and there were two spots in the pond. We called one the Sandy Beach, and it was on the other side of the pond. We have to go around the bottom of it, and it was where a small stream flowed into it. Well, the stream started about a quarter of a mile up in the hoppers, a beautiful cold spring, and it flowed down in there. And, of course, it brought a lot of sand over the centuries, and there was a good lot of sandy spot there, and we called it Sandy Beach, I guess it was. But we all learned to swim there, Mildred and myself and also my two cousins, my cousin Herbert and Edward. We had a summer, we had an awful lot of fun doing that. And, of course, I learned to stay underwater and used to see how long I could stay, and I learned to really swim underwater, both hands and feet, before I dared venture out in water that was over my head. And, of course, we also had another vehicle of propulsion in the pond. Occasionally, we'd find these planks that were about 2x12s, I'd say. Usually they're rotted a bit anyway, but we'd lay on them on our bellies, and we'd paddle with one hand on one side and one on the other, and we'd go out into the deep water and go all the way around with just like a little boat, and that was fun. But we all learned to swim there, and of course then we learned up on the other end of the pond was what they called the swimming hole. And it was just a nice, on the shore there was a nice, U-shaped, beach area, and the bottom there was gravelly. It was gravelly. And usually when you say go and swim, do we go up the swimming hole or go over Sandy Beach? So that, I just begin to remember a lot of that stuff. Now, that was 1924. Now, well, we all got more proficient in swimming, and one of the things to try out to prove how good you were was to swim the length of the pond and back again. And that was a great adventure, because after you left the sandy beach area and went up to the swimming hole, you would pass through a lot of places where there were stumps, you know, that had been cut off years ago when they were making the pond. And you'd be swimming, and all of a sudden there's a slimy old thing, and oh my gosh, oh, it was just a stump. And that was something to accomplish, swim the length of the pond. There was the canal that ran out of the pond, and this canal was made especially because it was dug and big banked on the side to supply water to a factory down below. Oh, half a mile down below was a factory that they made underwear. They called it the stockinette, they called it, but they had long underwear, the type with an open back on it. I guess they made other kind of things there, but they used the water to wash some of their operations or clean it or something or other. But the pond would be about level with the water in the canal, and then sometime in the afternoon or the evening they would start using the water down below, and the water would drop about a foot in the canal while they were doing it. But that was okay, but it was not good for us kids who were skating. Because in the winter time, the canal was an ideal place to skate and play hockey. You play hockey because it was you had a hockey rink that had a bank on one side and another bank on the other side, and you didn't have to worry about the puck. You flung it this way and that way, and we used to play there. Of course, we never did have any hockey sticks at all. We made our hockey sticks out of piece of wood that curved around the bottom, and most of the time the puck was a tin can. we whacked away at the thing and ourselves, and sometimes our hands got real bloody by the time we came home at night. There was a lot of fun there too, and of course we could skate on the pond, but it was very tricky because in the evening, in the winter time, about 5 o'clock or so, all of a sudden, the center of the ice dropped right down in a big V, and you better get out of there fast because they're using the water down below. Yeah, I can't remember some of those things. Now, that summer of 1924 was the time we had the adventure with the rented boat. The caretaker up there by the name of Pelkey, Mr. Pelkey, had a boat down on the Burgess Pond, and it was on the shore, on the edge of the shore, and he had a long chain around a tree with a padlock on it, so you couldn't use it or shouldn't use it, but you could rent it. You could rent it and we rented it one day. 25 cents a day it cost to rent it. And we rented it one late afternoon, and we were going to be able to keep it until the next late afternoon. Well, we had it. He would, after we paid him, he would give us the oars, and we took the oars home, and we had them stacked up against the house there. And when my dad got home, He said, you don't go out in the boat until after supper. Do not go out in the boat until after supper. So he went back in, and I don't know what his chores were or something or other. Half an hour later, we sneaked the oars away from the house, and there was my sister Mildred and my brother, my cousin Herbert, and Edward, I think. Anyway, we went out down to the pond, and we got out. We got the boat out, and we're rowing the boat, and we rowed up to the other end, near where the swimming hole was. And we got, unfortunately, the boat ran up on one of those stumps that was half submerged, and we kind of couldn't get off it. We started pushing and high, and alongside on the pond. On the side of the pond, all of a sudden, there's a great big figure comes along. There was our dad, and he was not happy at all. Well, we got off of there. finally and rode the thing back. But when we come walking back to the house, very sheepish, having done something that we were specifically told not to do, the only thing I still remember very much is we approached the house. There was my father, and he was unbuckled his belt, and he's pulling the belt off. Well, he did. He hit me with that belt once. And it's the only time he ever struck me that I remember. And I remember from then to this day, and I needed it, you know. I don't know what Mildred's punishment was, but the two cousins were not spanked at all anyway. But they cried. Both of them cried. They were in such terrible shape because everybody had gone and did something that was entirely forbidden. Oh, the next year that I can remember was 1925, banner year, because that was the year I was graduated from John Jennings School. And we had to go every quite a few mornings in June to go down to the high school to rehearse for the graduation ceremonies that they were, the songs and things we would sing at graduation. But the best thing about that graduating class was the baseball season, because, of course, John Jennings had a baseball team, and they played all the other schools there in the spring of 1925. And I had tried out for the baseball team, and of course, when it got down to the decisions on who's going to be on the team, there were 9 regular players and 2 substitutes, and Freddie was one of the substitutes. But I got a uniform just the same, and I didn't ever get to play in the game, though. They never needed any substitutes. But I was so proud of that uniform, and I used to wear it home at night, and I refused to take it off right away. I'd go out and play with my uniform on because I was sort of showing off or something or other. But I had planned to go to Boy Scout camp that summer in 1925, and suddenly it got changed for me because my cousins Herb and Ed were coming up from Brooklyn, and they were going to stay for a month or something or other, so I couldn't go to camp. And I felt very bad about that and left out in every way. However, I lived. I don't remember that summer too well about it. The boys were cousins were up there, and we also went another trip to Brooklyn with them after a while. But we did do a lot of blueberry picking that summer because there were a lot of places up in the hoppers and around where we had found blueberry bushes, and we would go up to blueberrying a lot of the tip, and which was a wonderful thing to do because when you bring back a few quarts of blueberries, usually it ended up that you got a blueberry pie to have for supper, and that was a great reward. I've been fishing that spring in all the brooks around that were close enough for me to walk to, particularly Sucker Brook that runs into Burgess Pond, and another one that comes down from a Shady Dell, and then there's one up Burlington Avenue. Newell's Brook was one of them, and Gaylord's Brook was another one. And I brought home a lot of speckled trout, the famous Salvelinus fontinalis that I got to know so well. Fishing was great in those days. In September of 1925, I started high school. I was to be a freshman in Bristol High School. Now, I'll tell you more about that. See you on the next tape.